Welcome to the TARDIS Library, a place to talk comics, novels, audios and more from the worlds of Doctor Who.
G'day everyone and welcome to this month's TARDIS Library. We have a fairly short episode this time around. It's either feast or famine, particularly with regard to the Titan comics. I think if you listened to our last episode of the TARDIS Library, we had tons of comic reviews. This time around, they've been much scarcer on the ground, so I dare say by the time we talk to you again, probably the whole team will be back with one or two reviews each, and next episode will be quite long. So if you like the shorter episodes, make the most of this one. Before we kick off with some Titan comics from Kevin, I just want to mention the new Class novels. For those of you who have been watching Class, there's a series of three novels out so far. They are, I've got one in front of me right now, Joyride by Guy Adams, What She Does Next Will Astound You by James Goss, and yes, that one does have a bit of a theme running through it of taking all those cliched comments you see online, trying to get you to click through to clickbait articles. I think it's given them over to chapter titles in that one. I've not read it yet. And finally, The Stone House by A.K. Benedict. Now, I've been reading the first one so far, Joyride, and I won't go into a full review here, but because this is a short episode, I thought I might just mention that the books exist and maybe read a section from one just to give you a bit of a taste and perhaps to show you that these aren't, well, they're certainly not children's books, and even young adult seems a bit of a stretch. And you'll know why when I read the following. It's a longish section, but I think it will highlight what I mean quite well. Okay. If anyone suspects this isn't the first time Poppy has stolen a car, the meal she makes of it sets them straight. After 20 seconds spent trying to break the driver's window of a silver Honda with a small stone and a lot of screaming, she should, by rights, end her sudden streak of rebellion right there. But the woman who rushes over to stop her is holding her own car keys in her hand. Three vicious punches later and Poppy is running towards the open driver's door of her new ride, its owner howling on the ground with a broken nose. Roar of ignition, crump of metal as she reverses back into the car parked behind her, and then a squeal of petrified tyres as she's tearing out of the car park at 50 miles an hour. Behind her, the car she rammed is blaring out its alarm like an indignant old lady, unable to quite believe the sheer audacity of the behaviour she's just witnessed. It's pure good luck that there's a break in the traffic as Poppy pulls out onto the road. Fortunate, too, that the solitary pedestrian on the zebra crossing is quick enough to throw herself out of the way before Poppy hits her. The sluggish traffic is bothering some people, tutting and complaining, offering frequent insults to the traffic lights. It doesn't bother Poppy. Poppy doesn't seem bothered by anything as she hammers the horn and straddles the white line, other cars veering out of her way as she refuses to slow down. One guy, still seething from a particularly lousy meeting at head office of the marketing company where he works, decides there's no way he's going to be the one to back down. He's spent the last 2 hours backing down. Gregson, still swaggering from the success of his pitiful campaign for a broadband supplier, had trashed every single one of his ideas until, by the end of the meeting, the oily little sod had won the damn account off him. No more. This silly cow coming up behind him was going to have to be the one to swerve. He's thinking that right up until he yanks the steering wheel at the last minute and sends his car into the back of the truck delivering building supplies. The second to last thing that goes through his head is, why does today hate me so much? The last thing to go through his head is a piece of scaffolding. His lousy day ends with his head looking like an angry cocktail cherry. If Poppy notices, she doesn't care. She's now 4 minutes away from the window of a betting shop and a final, brief leap through the windscreen of this car. Nobody calls the police. They're far too busy filming Poppy on their phones. The news channels are spoilt for choice when it comes to wobbly camera footage. That evening, Poppy will be a TV star, or at least the back of her head will be. There is only one vaguely usable shot of her from the front, and it shows a face that even her closest friends don't recognize. A wild, screaming, laughing, evil face, all teeth and eyes so big they look like they're about to bounce down onto her red cheeks. The last casualty of the journey, other than herself, is a man trying to fit a stepladder into the back seat of his car. It's not Poppy that hits him, it's a car veering out of her way, slamming the back door on him so hard you could have folded his remains like a shop display t-shirt. 2 minutes away from the betting shop window. A group of school kids cheer as Poppy goes past. To them, this seems fun, a bit of action to break up the long trudge home, something they can message their mates about later. They won't let facts get in the way of a good story. Each of them will claim they were nearly hit by the car. Each of them will claim they heard her laughing as she went by. She was laughing by all accounts, laughing every minute of the way, but there's no way they could have heard it over the roar of the engine and the constant beeping of car horns. One of them will even insist they got off with Poppy at a party, as if breathlessly cupping the breast of someone who would later go on to kill herself confers magic onto them. 1 minute away from the betting shop window. The last race at Aintree has been run. Nobody's made their fortunes. Stephen Patrick tears up his betting slip, takes a sip of cold vending machine tea, and wonders whether he can be bothered to cook tonight. Maybe he'll just stop in at the chippy on the way home. Oh, and by the way, what's all that noise outside? Car horns and a revving engine. Sounds like some kind of carnival is heading his way. When the window breaks, it sounds as if someone has let a firecracker off in the shop. The air is full of noise and glass. Nobody screams or shouts. It's all too sudden for that. There's just a lot of confused spinning and tumbling. Seconds ago, most people in the room were cursing their bad luck. 5 minutes later, and they'll have changed their minds. It's frankly phenomenal that nobody is seriously hurt. This isn't a big shop. In fact, on major race days, regular customers complain about the fact. But then they complain about most things. It certainly isn't big enough that you should be able to drive a car through it without killing everyone. There are injuries, of course. You don't add a rainstorm of shattered glass to a room without drawing a little blood. One of the older customers dislocates his hip as he's knocked back against the wall. Strangely, the worst injured of all is Mandy Taylor, who's working behind the counter. She's so shocked to see a car driving towards her, inside her place of work, a building not commonly troubled by motor traffic, that she topples back off her stool and cracks her head open on the low shelf behind her. She'll have serious concussion and a neck injury that will flare up for years to come. "Why do you think she did it?" WPD Delano's partner asks her as they lie in bed that night. The police officer's head is still replaying the sight of Poppy as her dead body is pulled back inside the darkness of the car. It's like prey being pulled back inside a bear's cave, she thinks, battered and beaten, softened up for easy chewing. "I haven't a clue," she tells him. "Not the first idea." She's not alone. And that's an example of the kind of violence, I guess, grit, I guess, realism that is in this book. There's also a touch of black humour to it. There's, well, I won't go on because this isn't a review. I just wanted to indicate that the books are out there and that although they're called young adult, they are quite worth the read. Like a lot of young adult literature truly is these days, I've got to say. It's a genre where I think adults still have a bit of a stigma about reading it sometimes, but it's often just as well written as adult fiction. Anyway, without any further ado, let's get into Kevin with his review of some Titan comics from this month, and I'll be back later in the show with something pretty special, quite timely, even though it relates to a second-hand Doctor Who book.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to some more Doctor Who reviews. Apologies, but it's going to be a short one this month, with just a single comic to look at. The intention is to catch up on the final two issues of Supremacy of the Cybermen in time for December. Moving right along then, let's take a look at issue 10 of year 2 of The Adventures of the 12th Doctor. It's time for part 2 of Playing House from George Mann and Rachel Stott. Remove those headphones if you don't want to know certain aspects of the story, as there will be spoilers from this point on. So in the previous issue, the Doctor and new companion Hattie found themselves in the windswept English countryside, thanks to the TARDIS. Investigating an innocent-looking house, they instead discovered that it was anything but normal, trapped in a labyrinth of endless corridors and seemingly infinitely variable rooms. The pair not only encountered distressed Mum Holly, who had lost her entire family to the mysterious mansion, but also the ghost-like Spiralites, temporal scavengers who feed on vortex energy. Following them to the heart of the structure, the Doctor discovered the chilling reality. The house is really another TARDIS, and something is very wrong. As this new issue opens, we see the Spiralites gorging themselves on the white globes of energy hanging from the architectural reconfiguration system, that giant tree-like machine we last saw in Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS. The Doctor interrogates Holly about her activities before she entered the house, and everything went crazy, and deduces that she accidentally brought home the shell of a TARDIS disguised as an everyday object. Unfortunately, this TARDIS is dying, leaking Archon energy everywhere and losing control of its internal dimensions. Instead of collapsing in on itself, the time ship has merged with the family home and is expanding exponentially. The immeasurable number of rooms will continue to spill out across the Earth until the planet implodes under the strain. This all means nothing to Holly. She just wants to find her children. The Doctor tries to calm her down by saying that the TARDIS has them safe and will lead them to their location. Hattie figures out this means the cellar. That's what all those psychic projections of children running were for. But the way is locked, and the countdown clock has chimed 7. Time is running out. Wooden doors are no match for an angry mother, though, and Holly kicks her way through to a maze of twisting stairways, which eventually lead to a tearful reunion with her family. Chatting to the two children, the Doctor learns that they know the way to the TARDIS console room, or the new kitchen, as they call it. Following the kids through a dizzying array of ever more bizarre locations, everyone finally arrives in the vast control room as the clock chimes 3, but a number of very corporeal-looking spiralites are already there. While Hattie, Holly and her husband grapple with the monsters, the Doctor attempts to reconfigure the TARDIS controls. As the battle appears to be lost, Hattie remembers that hugely signposted plot point from last issue and forces the spiralites back by throwing salt at them. Thankfully, the Doctor manages to reset the malfunctioning TARDIS long enough to separate it from the house and bring everything back to normal. The spiralites are gone, and Holly's family are safe at last. Saying their goodbyes, the Doctor and Hattie rematerialise in space to see the poor lost TARDIS finally explode at the heart of a star. There's just time for one last guitar jam session before Hattie's taken back to her home on the twist. It appears it really was just one trip in time and space. So, it might seem that I've skimmed lightly over the plot in this issue, but here's the first problem. I really haven't. That's pretty much all there is. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's some interesting pieces for Rachel Stott to work her artistic magic on, and I'll come back to those later. But in story terms, it's pretty weak and seems very rushed. Once again, George Mann's let me down with his conclusion. I should know better by now. Let's look at things in a bit more detail. Firstly, there was no real sense of peril here. Yes, the TARDIS was expanding and the clock was counting down. But to what? We never find out what would have happened if it had reached zero, only that it had been bad and that the Earth was in peril. Secondly, to resolve the whole situation, the Doctor has to do little more than punch a few buttons. Come on. When you've got the infinitely variable playground of the TARDIS to work with, surely there's a chance to come up with something a bit more original? Make something up? Add something new to our knowledge about how TARDISes work? Thirdly, whose ship was it anyway? And why was it abandoned? Maybe the writers are going to address this further down the line, but a throwaway question from the Doctor wouldn't have hurt to set things up. I'm also a bit surprised that the Doctor just chose to destroy the malfunctioning TARDIS instead of investigating things further. Finally, the spiralites, who turned out to be completely ineffectual, scared off by a little salt, which was conveniently available. And why did the console room develop into a second kitchen exactly? I know it merged with the family's house somehow, but it's a bit of a stretch. Surely I can't be the only one who's asking these kind of questions. As far as the characters are concerned, the Doctor's his usual mercurial self, and I've no problem with how he's portrayed. But Hattie walks off stage after having had zero chance at development, beyond repeatedly saying, "Doctor, you make no sense." There's a hint that her story may not be completely over, but to be honest, I've no great desire to see her again. On the positive side, there is a nice undercurrent of how a mother's love for her family can drive her to overcome huge obstacles, and Holly does come across as very strong-willed. Though I may be disappointed with the script, it's the complete opposite with the pictures. I raved about Rachel Stott's artwork last month, and it's more superlative this time. As I hoped, she makes the most of the setting to develop unusual panel designs and page layouts, and produce some simply beautiful images. I defy anyone not to be impressed by the depiction of the giant console room, with its massive walkways rising from a pit of bizarre-looking machinery worthy of Jack Kirby himself. You want variation in your TARDIS rooms? Rachel gives it to you in spades, with one simple stunning widescreen illustration showing a village street crystal caves, a rose garden, a parade of shops, and even a submarine. It's wonderful. The Doctor's even more energetic than last issue. He constantly looks to be on the move, dashing from one place to the next. His body is active as his brain. If I have to pick one favourite image, it has to be the full-page shot as he explains how the Dieting TARDIS is expanding. One hand on his hip and the other raised in the air, his eyes vibrant under those attack eyebrows. Conversely, if I have one tiny criticism, it's the portrayal of Hattie seems a little inconsistent at times. But it's a minor flaw in an otherwise marvellous tapestry. I'm starting to wonder if Rachel might have her own Doctor Who story to tell someday. And what wonder she might produce as both writer and artist. So the scores on the doors are probably 4 out of 10 with a must try harder for the story, and an 8 out of 10 for the artwork. An interesting read, let down by yet another too swift resolution. A quick glance at the variant covers reveals some fine penmanship from Mike Collins and Warren Police. But star billing goes to Mariano Lacaustra and his interpretation of Escher's famous hand with reflecting sphere. Mariano's back on interior art duties next issue, along with returning writer Robbie Morrison. Of course, I'll be taking a look at that issue in next month's episode. Right, I'm off. See you next time. And remember, the owls are not what they seem.
Andrew Skilleter has worked in most areas of illustration, but has concentrated on book covers. He has, for instance, painted the illustrations for more than 40 Ruth Rendell crime novels. He is best known for his Doctor Who paintings, however. His illustrations have appeared on books, videotapes, calendars and posters, while the original paintings are sought after by collectors on both sides of the Atlantic. In a varied career, he has set up his own publishing company and has produced Doctor Who books and calendars, as well as a biography of Frank Hampson, the creator of Dan Dare. That's the inside back cover, just let me shut it, of Blacklight, the art of Andrew Skilleter. This is a large format Virgin book from about 1996, I believe, which collects together the art of Doctor Who illustrator Andrew Skilleter. And the reason I thought it might be interesting to mention, being a 20-year-old book, and we don't do a lot of older stuff on the show, is recently Andrew started up his Who Dares publishing company again. In that brief blurb about him, it mentioned him publishing material, and that was with Who Dares back in the 80s and early 90s. And what he's done most recently is reprinted a calendar he produced many years ago using a lot of covers he had drawn and painted for the the Virgin New Adventures. He did do some Virgin New Adventures, but no, for the Target novels, the classic era Doctor Who novels, he did many covers for those, many of the really great classic covers too. So a coffee table book like this, where a lot of those great covers are reproduced generally without the Doctor Who logo on them, so they're just the illustration, is a really fun thing. Of course, it's kind of hard to talk about illustrations on an audio-only format. I do realise that. So, aside from the fact many of you will be familiar with Andrew's work, I thought it might be a good thing to open the book and read you the introduction. The introduction is probably the least interesting section of the book, even though it is interesting in its own right, because then the later chapters get into him talking about how he met with publishers and started drawing Doctor Who stuff and how everything went from there. And it's a really, really good read. We'll talk about how to get a copy of the book, get your hands on one of these later in this review. But for now, let's open the book again and let's read. Introduction, Full Circle. The images in this book represent a selection of my Doctor Who illustrations from 1979 to 1994. I have travelled full circle from my first cover for W.H. Allen to this collection for Virgin Publishing, who now own that original imprint. I hope the work will be appreciated both as interpretations of the Doctor Who myth and as pieces of illustration. Apart from a few years when I was fully involved with Who Dares, Doctor Who has always been only part of my output. At the start of the book, there are a few examples of my work to help place this collection in the context of my broader career. I have attempted to give some insight into the life of an illustrator, the process of illustration and the technique, and to tell for the first time in the hope that it may be of interest, the full story of my involvement over 15 years with the Doctor Who phenomenon. I can unashamedly admit that, for me, illustration is a vocation. It was all I ever wanted to do, and the only career I have ever had. From an early age, I was absorbed by the visual image, particularly if it was connected with a dramatic story of some kind. Among my earliest memories are the colour picture strips illustrated by great talents such as Ron Embleton, Frank Hampson, and Frank Bellamy in the 50s, the perfect synthesis of drama and imagery. I was aware that images were associated with words, symbols, and lettering, and I wrote, drew, and created my own childish magazines, which my long-suffering parents had to digest. The awareness of the context of a visual image is a crucial part of an illustrator's work. Into the 60s, my influences and inspiration still continued to come largely from the best picture strip illustrators of the time, including Keith Watson. Strangely, from the time of entering art college, I did not translate these influences into my illustrative work, and instead I embraced different kinds of illustration. I have often wondered why. One element was undoubtedly a reaction against the kind of work and against a genre which I associated with my younger years, as well as a feeling that it did not fit with what would be expected of me as a student. Whatever the reason, it was not until Doctor Who crossed my path that I connected professionally with the area of science fiction. I established myself as an illustrator with a single-minded determination. I had a romantic vision of the artist in his smoke-filled studio, meeting deadline after deadline, dependent on his own resources, answerable only to his clients, and above all, a professional. My path as an illustrator has been, and still is, a varied one. There has scarcely been an area of illustration in which I have not been involved. This must reflect the fact that in my more mature years I developed a wide appreciation of the visual image, from influences as varied as the paintings of the Renaissance to a broad range of illustration. I was always most drawn to the well-finished, the pieces with attention to detail. While I recognise that it is often the artist who consolidated one area that is best known in the profession, I have enjoyed the flexibility and freedom that a varied workload brings. It has also given me greater opportunities to draw, which I enjoy a good deal. I have felt, on occasions, that my drawing was better than the painting that finally emerged. During the 70s, there was a mainstream demand, particularly with cover illustration, for illustrators to be painters, and certainly over the years I've had to develop my technique and become more ambitious in how and what I paint. This book represents a unique opportunity for me to consolidate a single theme of illustration in which my role has been one of imaginative visual interpreter, with narrative images, montages, graphic illustration, and portraiture all playing their part. The work has required me to be part interpreter, part imaginative visualizer, and part documentary artist, authentically reproducing what has been seen on the television screen. I have a privileged position of having worked in such a variety of ways and over such a long period with this legendary television program. And that's from Andrew Skilleter, December 1994. That's quite some time ago, as you'll appreciate, so it's great to see Andrew back publishing things with Who Dares again. And while this introduction goes on, there's a bunch of other work that Andrew's done, non-Doctor Who work, which is quite interesting to look at. Even a picture of some classic cricketers. I think it might be W.G. Grace or someone like that. My gosh, it's a great image. He is a really great artist. You will know his work as I turn some of these pages. What's the first thing I see? It's the cover for The Demons, 1979 W.H. Allen book, obviously reprinted as a Target paperback. Just a fantastic image. As I mentioned earlier, there's no Doctor Who logo on this. It's just the pure image of Azal standing there in the crypt. Just great. And as these chapters go on and as you flick through the images, he has written quite a lot, as I say, about meeting the Doctor Who publishers and getting briefs and things like that. As I turn the page here, The Androids of Tara, Keeper of Trak, and you can probably hear the pages turning. Power of Kroll, Enlightenment, the Five Doctors cover, which I adored as a kid. I still adore now. It's you probably remember it. It's a metallic silver cover, but there's a diamond shape in the middle that has the TARDIS, K9, Cybermen, Daleks, and in the middle the five faces of the Doctor in profile. Just fantastic. Next to that's the Abominable Snowman, and look, we're only on page 15, if I turn it over, the Silurians, the video cover from the BBC video of 1993. We're only a few pages in, relatively, and there's already such classic artwork here. And I know, again, podcasting is not a visual medium, so I won't go on telling you about all these great images, because you can either grab the book for yourself, or you already know the images. You probably have these books on your shelf already, particularly the Target books. The videos, sadly, have gone by the wayside, haven't they? People have gotten rid of those, and the artwork was never really reproduced on DVD, so a lot of that artwork is lost in many ways, unless it pops up in things like Who Dares calendars or books like this. Now, how to get your hands on a copy? Isn't that a good question? I like to use a service called Bookfinder. I know eBay is probably easy for many people, but I use bookfinder.com. And what that pulls together is a lot of people, many of whom do sell on eBay as well, but also some smaller used bookshops and so on will use it. And you just key in what country you're from, and it will give you, when you find the book you want, it will show you the price, including postage, in your own currency. I find it a very easy site to use. And just keying in Skillitter as the author and Blacklight as the name of the book, it seems around 30 to 40 Australian dollars would today get me a copy of this book in hardcover, in good condition. I'd typically look for very good condition, but good condition, yeah, could live with that. So it's not a cheap book by any means. I mean, I recently bought a Peter Haining hardcover of 25 Glorious Years to replace my soft cover, and it was 70p. So there are some big Doctor Who books, hardcover Doctor Who books from 30 odd years ago, that are very, very, very cheap, unbelievably cheap. I think the book was 70p and postage was £7. It was quite crazy. But in this case, Blacklight is a book that was probably published in much smaller numbers than, say, the Peter Haining books of the 80s, and also is a very popular book, so you are going to pay for it. Obviously, that $30 to $40, again, is Australian money. It would be less in US dollars and less, again, in pounds. But use bookfinder.com, see what you can dig up. There are, of course, mint condition copies that will go for a lot more. You know, maybe Australian $60, $80, $100. It really, really can vary. You see books on Bookfinder for ridiculous prices at times. But I guess you could say this is my recommendation for you to buy the book. If you like Doctor Who artwork, if you like hearing about someone's life as an illustrator, and I think that introduction gave you a good feel for how Andrew wants to couch the book and how he does talk all the way through the book about his illustration work, it's a really good read. It's something different. It's not about Doctor Who on the television. It's not about the team making Doctor Who. It's about something one step removed, yet is still deeply, deeply Doctor Who. When you see any of his book covers or any of his video covers or any of the calendar images, you will know it's an Andrew Skillitter image. And indeed, he's recently done an image for the Milk reprint of what was formerly called The Life and Scandalous Times of John Nathan Turner. It's being reprinted. I can't think of its new title. It has a less scandalous title, and he has done the cover for that, Andrew Skillitter. He's done a lovely JNT in a Hawaiian shirt for the front of that. So he's still out there, he's still active, he's still producing new stuff as well as reprinting his old stuff. And if you're into that, Blacklight, this book, is well worth your time. Check it out. Okay, some late mail from me here. I have in my hands a review copy of Doctor Who, The Third Doctor, The Heralds of Destruction, Part 3. This is written by Paul Cornell. The artist is Christopher Jones, with colour by Hi-Fi. You will have heard in past episodes of the TARDIS Library, I've reviewed the earlier issues of that, and I'm delighted to be able to review this issue because I'm really enjoying the what I would call the past Doctors, the classic Doctors in the Titan comics. You've heard Kevin reviewing the Fourth Doctor, for example. I am just itching for there to be a Fifth Doctor comic at some stage. I'm sure there will be. The Eighth Doctor, who I regard as a classic Doctor, has been done as well. And they've all come across really well. I guess we see the Matt Smith Doctor and the Capaldi Doctor and Tennant. We've seen them on television in the last few years. And so seeing a Doctor like Pertwee pop up in comic book form is just something different, something fun, something fantastic, and I really, really enjoy it. Now, I won't go through it blow by blow, but you might remember when we left off the last issue. The Pertwee Doctor was being choked by something around his neck in very typical Pertwee style while he was trapped in Joe Grant's imagination. Joe Grant comes to his rescue with a book. She hits this tentacle with a book and it disappears. And the book she holds up is called Everything I've Learned in the Last 3 Years by Joe Grant, which is a nice tribute, I guess, to the fact that the Joe Grant character does learn a lot from the Doctor during her time with him. Back at unit headquarters, the second Doctor and the Brigadier are looking at the bodies of the third Doctor and Joe Grant, who are still in this state of, I guess, stasis. They've been taken over by the micro machines. That's why they're in Joe Grant's head. That's what's going on. And the Troughton Doctor thinks he knows someone who can help, and he rapidly runs away from the scene and is taken out of things. Meanwhile, back in Joe Grant's head, the third Doctor finally comes across the hive mind controlling all of these micro machines, both the ones that have taken over their bodies and the ones that are in the village that UNIT are fighting, and I presume elsewhere on the Earth as well. And Pertwee has what is a very Pertwee conversation with these micro machines. When you think of the Pertwee Doctor trying to, well, when you think of all Doctors, they try and reason with the alien threat, they try and find a common ground and so on, and the Pertwee Doctor here is, you know, reaching out. The form of this micro machine hive mind is very crystalline, and so Pertwee's reaching out, he's touching the crystals, he's saying, I can feel you in my mind, speak to me, I will understand you, and he's being very calm and very rational and all the things you expect the Pertwee Doctor to be, and the micro machine is talking to him in very stilted English. For example, there's a panel where he says, confined, forced to be what we are not. And the Pertwee Doctor's, you know, rubbing his chin, and he says, well, yes, I can understand that, old fella. Keep in mind, this is the Pertwee Doctor who has his dematerialization circuit back. Only just recently, but he does have it back. And he says to this micro machine, I was imprisoned here on Earth. Who I was changed to fit in. Perhaps they thought I'd be too cruel otherwise. Perhaps they thought I'd get used to my cage. Perhaps I did. Because here I am, free once more, and yet I'm still hanging about, still pretending to care about gentlemen's clubs. Of course, Joe Grant hears this, because they're in Joe Grant's head, and she gets a bit upset that the Doctor is talking about the fact that he could be off in his TARDIS, and she basically says, well, if you'd rather do that, well, off you blinking go. It's a very Joe and Doctor conversation. The Doctor assures her that, you know, he likes his Earth friends, that's why he's around, and everything's fine. Meanwhile, this has calmed down, this conversation has calmed down the micro machine hive mind to the point where the Doctor and Joe are released back into their bodies, and back at the village where UNIT is fighting the micro machines, they've still got them encased in a force field, but the micro machines aren't really fighting back, and so things are sort of calming down. Benton and Yates go off and have a bit of a conversation. Benton asks how Yates's date with Joe Grant went. If you remember back to the first issue, they were in a Thai restaurant having a date. He says he doesn't think it went too well, you know, and she'll probably just run off with the Doctor in his box soon anyway. And Benton says, oh, and we'll never see her again, like with Miss Harriet, which is a nice throwback to Zoe. At that point, I thought, they're mentioning Zoe, and the second Doctor's run off to get someone. I wonder if the second Doctor's running off to grab Zoe. I know it sounds completely bonkers, but it doesn't actually turn out to be the case. Back at UNIT headquarters, the Brigadier, or the character who's been playing the Brigadier, is revealed to be the Master under yet another rubber mask. I think that's it's at least his second, if not his third, for this comic series. I think he's 3 from 3 for the 3 issues so far. So this comic does delight, I think, in taking some of the tropes of 70s Pertwee Doctor Who and just playing with them to the point where, as I say, the Master has used 3 different rubber masks already. The Doctor, meanwhile, the second Doctor, is off to Electronic Con. He pulls up in a UNIT Jeep, he flashes his pass and goes inside. But before you can concentrate too much on that, we're back at UNIT headquarters. The Doctor and the Master get into a bit of martial arts. And again, having a bit of fun with the 70s tropes, we have the Master, you know, slashing at the Doctor, saying, my Martian Kendo is superior to your ridiculous Venusian Aikido in every possible way. And they're kicking and they're flipping and the Pertwee Doctor eventually says, you won't mind if I try some Mercurian Kung Fu instead. So it's really, really taking the piss out of this era, but in a fun way, in an appreciative way, respectful way, I would say. You know, this is fun. It's not being cruel. This little segment after the Master and Doctor have gotten it out of their systems after their little fight, we find that the Brigadier's been locked up in a cabinet. He's looking very dishevelled, and he says, "Ah, Doctor, would you be so kind as to get me out of here before the men see me?" Very Lethbridge Stewart. So, unit soldiers arrive, the Master's bailed up again, and he's been trying to tell the Doctor something, I think, for the past couple of issues. I think he was trying to tell him in the first issue, that's why he was trying to make his way to see the Doctor. And it turns out that what he's trying to tell the Doctor, and we get some interesting cutscenes to what the second Doctor is up to while the Master is talking. Because what the Master is talking about is that he has found that the second Doctor, or who people think is the second Doctor, is not really the second Doctor at all. While he's saying all of this, we're seeing what the second Doctor is up to. We see the second Doctor change clothes, and we learn that the second Doctor is ... Should I say? Should I not say? I think people would have guessed by now. Oh gosh, if you don't want to be spoiled, turn off now, because I will reveal it. The second Doctor is actually Ramon Salamander. Bum, bum, bum. So another big reveal in this comic book. All up, this comic, as I've said in the past couple of reviews, is very reverential to the 70s. That's what I was trying to say earlier as well. It delights in taking the tropes of the 70s and playing with them. It is, I have said, a bit of a shame that the second Doctor's back with the third Doctor so quickly after the three Doctors. But now with the added reveal that it's not really the second Doctor at all, but it's Salamander, I guess that's turned on its head, and it's not actually the second Doctor. I'm sure Paul Cornell might have been listening to our review, or maybe reading other reviews that said similar, and thinking, oh, I haven't brought the second Doctor back, guys, but I can't tell you why. Well, now we know why. It's Salamander. That just leaves the variant covers, I guess, to discuss for this issue. The main cover is an interesting cartoony sort of Pertwee. Not too bad. You'd be pretty happy if you got it. The picture cover, the photo cover, I should say, is very attractive. Again, rare for photo covers, but the Pertwee comics have done pretty well on that count. It's a very craggy-looking Pertwee. I'm wondering if that's a picture from when he was, maybe after he'd left the role, or certainly very late in the role. I've got a feeling it might be a shot from like the early 80s or something. It's hard to tell. Anyway, the third cover is somewhere in between the two. It's cartoonish, but a little bit more realistic. It's got the third Doctor and Joe in Bessie with the Brigadier in the back seat, pistol out, pointing with his other finger, a really action sort of scene. I don't know which of these three I'd prefer. Possibly the photo cover, which is really rare for me because I don't normally like photo covers. So that's something. The next issue has some interesting covers. We'll talk about those next time, of course. And look, all that's really left is to give it a mark out of 10. I think this is a solid 8 out of 10. I've been happy with all of the Third Doctor comics so far. I think this one and the first one were my favourites. I think the second one took that little dip that most second episodes or second issues want to do. And so that's fine. But it's back on track here. And if you love the Pertwee Doctor, you love UNIT, you love the tropes of that era, it just does not get any better than this. This is absolutely what you want. And now, with this added second Doctor / Salamander plot, that's really interesting. That's really cool. And hats off to Paul Cornell for coming up with that, because I'm really, really intrigued to get my hands on the next issue. Anyway, that's all from this issue, and that's all from the TARDIS library this time around. If you have any comments, you can use the Doctor Who Show email, which is hello@thedwshow.net, and you can write to any of the people doing reviews here on the show, which I guess this time was myself and Kevin, but normally we have many more people. So if you have a comment for any of us, please write into that address, let us know what you think. And if you're not listening to the other shows on our feed, give them a try too. We've got reviews of all the latest Class episodes, we've got the flagship Doctor Who Show, we've got the Letter Lords, we've got Ian Martin's A to Z, and from time to time we also have little one-offs, like a recent interview with Sophie Aldred, that I conducted, and that's up on our feed at the moment too. So if this is your first taste of the Doctor Who show, or you're only listening to the TARDIS Library or whatever it might be, we have so much more on the feed, and it would be great if you could give it a listen. Let us know what you think. We'll see you next month on the TARDIS Library.